The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. Well, this morning we continue with our exploration of the Lojong slogans. And we're moving now into the second part two. Some people call it part three, but we don't. We know that it's the second part two. And that is relative bodhicitta, or relative compassion. So we've been exploring for these past few days the preliminaries, the reminders, which are so similar to our five remembrances, and then the absolute compassion teachings, the absolute bodhicitta teachings. And it's become clear to me in our review of these practices how important the flow of these teachings are. Now, we've talked about how in Zen we introduce things somewhat randomly, trusting that everything is just one teaching. But in the Tibetan tradition and in other Buddhist traditions, there is a kind of an orderliness to the teachings. I've always believed that the koan curriculum, as we call it, is also very orderly. It draws us through certain gaps in our understanding of the way things are. And essentially, all practices in Zen, body and breath and shikantaza, which to me are all related practices about being embodied and upright in the middle of our lives, which can sometimes be quite chaotic, all of these teachings point us in similar directions, and that is to the ultimate nature of emptiness and form, of the absolute and the relative, of the way things appear to be nested in the way things are, and all the different permutations of those things. So in this teaching, to start with the preliminaries is so important because it reminds us why we're practicing. We're practicing because life is both brief and full of suffering and also full of opportunity. And we devote ourselves, dedicate ourselves to learning what it means to be a human being. And then we enter the realm of the teachings on bodhicitta, the heart wisdom, the source of compassion, both from the absolute point of view and the relative point of view, from the emptiness world and the form world. And as I said in an earlier talk, and Alan and David and Mike and I have all been saying at various times, there's something interesting about starting with the absolute before we move into the relative teachings, because our life starts with the relative and eventually moves into the absolute. So this reversal here, and this grounding, this very important grounding in the absolute nature of reality. This morning during our sutra service, we read a couple of short pieces, one from one of our lineage ancestors, Koan Yamada, about how compassion arises out of emptiness. Very, very similar, if not identical, to the Lojong teachings. And then this beautiful piece, which many of us are familiar with and have a lot of affection for, The Ship of Compassion by Miao Shi, a Zen teacher, in the not in our direct lineage, but a Japanese Zen teacher. And she says, and I'm going to just read this whole thing and then comment a little bit on it as a form of introduction to Tonglen practice, which is what I'll be beginning to talk about today. So she says, night rain washes the mountain cliffs, the dawn greens soaked through. Sitting, I meditate on emptiness as fresh breezes fill the temple. Words are inherently empty, and yet still I am fond of brush and ink. My mind like ashes after the fire, and yet still I am tied to the world. Window bamboo, empty mind, courtyard pine, innate purity, the trunk of this lofty green tree, neither inherently form nor no form. Between bell and fish drum, I have yet to grasp the essence of Dharma, yet I get a whiff of its fragrance, as if I were aboard the ship of compassion. So when we, when I read this the other night, and then thought about using it for this morning, and then we recited it earlier in the day, it touched me that she was pointing to the same teachings as Lojong points to. Things are not, and they most indubitably are. Words are empty, and yet still I like to write. My mind, like ashes, just everything burned up, and yet, you know, I'm tied to the world. These and yets, these back and forths, are the way we practice between absolute and relative. And this going back and forth is characteristic of all of the Mahayana teachings in Zen, in Tibetan Buddhism, the great vehicle, which looks towards the apparent contradiction of absolute and relative, and ultimately finds that absolute and relative are one thing. Just different views of the way the world appears to us, the way we encounter life. Sometimes everything drops away. Sometimes things just hit us in the face. On and on and on, this is how it goes. And how do we practice with this? And in Zen, we say we practice with this by noticing whatever's arising, being present with it, recognizing that we are in fact it. This is the way it is. Sometimes we have a clear view of it. Sometimes, as Miao Shi says, we just get a whiff of it. All of us are aboard the ship of compassion, but most of us don't know this and forget it. And we've gotten a whiff of it or a real immersion in it. We become drenched in it, like the night rain washing the mountain cliffs and the dawn green soaked through. We are drenched in compassion, and then we forget about it because we get pulled into the world of the relative again, where there's good and bad and right and wrong. Many years ago, David and I had the privilege, through our wonderful ignorance of things, to do a training, a workshop with Pema Chodron. We signed up for it. We're very excited because we'd read some of her books and thought she must be a great teacher. And I think we might have been after we'd seen her give a talk at the Providence Zen Center at a conference. And we were pretty impressed with her. We had no idea that she was a really famous person, like really famous, until we showed up at the workshop. We thought, oh, there may be a dozen people there, because that was our sense of Buddhist workshops at the time. And there were, I don't know, 100 people in this room. And I was remembering how disappointed I was, you know, that, oh, I thought I'd get to meet this woman. And we were just two people in the crowd. And her topic for this weekend was Tonglen. It was this practice that's part of the Lojong teachings, which she, I guess at the time, maybe was writing about in her book, Start Where You Are. So we listened to her teachings, received them. And one of the things that she said in describing Tonglen, which I've always remembered, is that she said very clearly, this is not an emptiness practice. This is a relative practice. This is a practice where you engage with the world through right and wrong, good and bad. You have to be able to make that differentiation. And she said, however, and this, she didn't tell us about the Lojong setting for this, the grounding in the absolute and then the moving into the relative. She just warned us. She said, "If whenever you do this practice, always remember to start with thusness, to start with shunyata, to start with the absolute. And then after you've done it for a while, return to the absolute, just so you don't get stuck in right and wrong, good and bad. And also in thinking that Tonglen practice might lead you into some sort of attitude of fixing people, fixing ourselves or fixing others, that is somehow taking away their suffering and replacing it with happiness. She was very clear that that is a trap. And in the years since, as I moved in and out of exploring Tonglen for myself, and I am not a Tonglen master or a person who knows everything there is to know about Tonglen. I want to make that very clear. But whenever I dip into the practice, I can feel the pull of the dualistic nature of it, of the relative nature of it. And I do it for a while, and I get caught in that trap, and then I just drop it because of that. And in preparing for this talk this morning, I read over her writings about Tonglen in her book Start Where You Are, and Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's writings in Training the Mind, and of course Norman Fisher's Zen version of these teachings. Remembering that Pema Chodron was a student of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, so it's refreshing to see his words come through her way of writing, a little bit adjusted for modern, or at least 20th century, Americans. And Norm Fisher, the Zen teacher, adjusting even further for us Zen practitioners. And all of them are very clear about this same matter, that to begin in the absolute is really, really important. And what is this absolute? It's the resting in undifferentiated awareness, as David spoke about so beautifully last night. It's recognizing that this world of differentiation, of this and that, of the relative, is also at the very same time a world of wholeness and beauty and reliability, just like leaning back into the salt-filled ocean and being lifted up by the salt water. This is utterly reliable, and when we learn to rely on it, which we learn in Zen practice as well, we learn it through breath meditation and through shikantaza and through the teachings of the koans, to rely on the absolute nature of everything. Not as an idea, because that would be an idea that would just, in the flicker of a moment, disappear. And of course it does. We hear these teachings. We think, oh, that sounds good. Yeah, everything's great. Everything's full of compassion. I want that. And then we try to pretend that we understand it. And boy, it is not understandable by the mind that makes this and that. At least that's been my experience. What is true for me anyway is that slowly, just like those dawn greens being soaked through, sometimes it rushes forward and sometimes it reverts, but some kind of endless opening to this reliable, loving nature that fills the universe. And if we have a limited view of love, then we miss it entirely, because it includes everything, which means it includes suffering, pain. It includes depression and anxiety. It includes anger and sadness and fear, as well as joy and happiness. It includes physical pain and difficulties with other people. There is nothing that is not included in it. In the Christian and Jewish traditions and in the Muslim traditions, we talk about God. That's the only word that we can come up with to describe this completely undifferentiated compassion, what we call in the Lojong teachings absolute bodhicitta, absolute compassion. It's just this one fabric of beneficence. And when our hearts are touched directly by that, we know it as if we were tasting water for the first time. This is the way our ancestor woman talks about it in the introduction to the Mu Koan. It is just like tasting water and knowing whether it is hot or cold. It's so clear. There's no doubt. It's not a theory. It is the thing itself. And the teachers of Tonglen warn us about this and then say, make sure to ground in this absolute understanding. Whatever we call it, absolute bodhicitta, wu or mu, thusness, the way things are, the compassion that fills the universe, this loving presence, this completely non-judgmental presence of the universe. It doesn't matter. Give it a name. Call it Fred. It doesn't matter what it is. But it is a thing that can be experienced. It is an actual living experience that is granted to human beings we can taste it, we can feel it, we can rely on it. And only then are we ready to enter the world of Tonglen. And in Tonglen, once we've grounded in this absolute quality, then we can rouse ourselves to face the unwanted, to face pain and suffering, not as a problem, but as something that arises on a regular basis in our lives. And everyone I've ever met, including myself, and even I've heard cutworms and animals and birds and all beings, every single living being, when confronted with pain, wants to push it away or run away from it. This is just normal, healthy animal life. Everything does this. You can watch little worms going towards the sugar water and then running away from the bitter. It's just part of being embodied. We don't like pain. And here's where Tonglen matches the teachings of koan practice, because it's about doing the thing that is upside down. My first teacher used to call Zen practice entering the upside down kingdom, the reverse of logic, the reverse of the way things are. Because if something's happening that we don't like, the wisest thing to do, we've been taught and we know in our gut, is just to say, no, I'm not doing this. I am going away from it. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to repair it. Or I'm going to just leave as soon as possible. Don't want to be with this. One of the things that really touched me in Norm Fisher's book is him talking about this in the context of relationships. In a loving relationship, pain arises. Difficulties arise. And we have to be willing to not run away and not try to fix the pain. If we think about people in our lives who have been really loving to us, they have listened to us, been with us in our pain, and not tried to fix it, not tried to repair it, not tried to smooth it over and make it nice. They've just been with us in the suffering. So hard to do, so difficult, because we just are moved to try to make everybody feel better. But this practice of Tonglen is not about feeling better, not whatsoever about feeling better. Please know that. It is not about repairing or comforting. It is about having the bravery, the courage, to do the opposite, the upside down of what we normally do, to invite suffering in, to say, oh, this hurts, let me take this on. So one of the slogans is to first do Tonglen for ourselves. So we notice when we are feeling something awful, something terrible, and it can be a little thing or a big thing. It can just be somebody says something to us and it's like an ouch kind of a thing. Instead of trying to say, well, they didn't really mean it, you know, this is a nice person, or boy, I'm never going to talk to that person again. Instead, we take it in and feel the ouch. We feel, oh, whoa, this feels awful. Pema Chodron likes to talk about the texture of the negativity, the texture of the pain. It feels dark and sticky and goopy. Norm Fisher says, if that doesn't work for you, just come up with something else that is visceral for you. Just some way that you know, oh, there's a contraction, there's an I don't like this, ugh, and really take it in. And the Lojong teaching on Tonglen is to let it ride the breath. So we actually breathe in the negative. We bear the negative by inviting it inside. Instead of doing the ordinary normal thing of saying, nope, not for me, gonna be happy, gonna smile, gonna make everything nice now. We know that there are some situations as we live our lives that cannot be fixed or repaired. And Tonglen comes as a beautiful teaching about this. We draw it inside of us. And the teaching is that only when we can draw it inside of us can we do that for other people. We have to know suffering for ourselves. We have to have stopped trying to fix or run this fight and flight that is built into the core of our animal brains. We have to learn how to do the opposite And Chögyam Trungpa is very funny about this. He says, it sounds impossible, but it's really not that hard. It's just do it, he says. And so for the last 12 hours, I've been doing it myself. And I got to say, he's right. It's not such a big deal. I don't know if that's because I've been practicing something like this for years or if suddenly something clicked for me. I don't understand it, but whoa, it's not so bad. It just bringing it in. And I got to tell you, I've had a life where really awful things have happened to me. No worse than any of the rest of you. I think I could count on the fact that everybody in this room has experienced terrible suffering, even just for a millisecond, and for many of us, for much longer than that. So I know this for myself, but I usually don't take it in like this, because it sounds kind of stupid and negative. Why would I hurt myself further? But Trungpa reassures us, you won't. It doesn't work like that. Because once you bring it in, grounded in the absolute, then something weird happens, and he does call it weird. The spaciousness that Candon was talking about, pointing to his lower abdomen, his lower rib cage, the spaciousness which just arises with the in-breath, right? Because with the in-breath, the ribs expand, the lungs expand, the diaphragm shifts. This is a physical thing. That spaciousness mixes together with the yucky, dark, sticky stuff that we've just taken in, and on its own creates a bigger container for it. As we sometimes say, that's called, Joko Beck used to talk about that as the ABC of Zen, a bigger container. It's the same teaching. It's not that the yuckiness disappears. It's that the yuckiness is seen as not being the whole thing. It's a very important teaching, a bigger container. It's sometimes a beautiful metaphor used for this is that if we put some salt in a small cup of water, the water gets really, really salty. And if we put the salt in a big bowl of water, it's a little bit salty. Maybe if we're making soup, just the right amount of saltiness. But when we put a little amount of salt in the ocean, it doesn't do anything. It's the ocean. It's the nature of the ocean. Big, big, big container. And this is what happens in Tonglen, at least in my experience. The horribleness, the yuckiness, it comes in and it doesn't change. But what does happen is that it gets set in a bigger context, a bigger container. And then the teaching in Tonglen is that we have to breathe out. So we've been breathing it in, and then we breathe out. And what gets breathed out is this weirdly spacious thing that's lighter and more open. And if we try to breathe out goodness and happiness, then that we're stuck in the relative again. That isn't the way it works. Instead, it's a natural process. The only things that we have to do are set ourselves up in the absolute, which is hard enough and takes probably a lifetime of practice. And then dare to breathe in what is difficult. Dare to engage with it by not resisting it. And, of course, resistance might happen, so then we breathe in the resistance as well. And then let it mix together with the breath, just like the Tonglen teachings invite us to, and then see what happens. And then remember that once we can do this for ourselves, maybe we'll dare to do it for others. All the Tonglen teachers say that this is an essential part of the process because it can't just be selfish. It can't just be that we keep this transformation to ourselves. It has to spread out everywhere. It has to be recognized that this is the actual nature of reality. The dark and the light, the relative and the absolute, the good and the bad, they mix together and create life itself. Life that vibrates with energy, that vibrates with bodhicitta. And then we have to remember, at the very end of the process, to rest once again in the absolute. Nothing has changed. Nothing has been transformed. There's no such thing as transformation in the relative sense. But But everything has changed. Our view has become more spacious. Our hearts have opened. Our minds have opened. And we see that the limited narratives that plague us are just that, limited. So this practice is quite rich, but it's a real trap if we look at it from the point of view of right and wrong, this and that, good and bad, or fixing. So I think the two energies that I'd like to encourage us in are the energy, the practice of opening to thusness, to shunyata, to God, to the benevolent nature of the universe that includes everything we consider negative. Doing that first, making sure that it's authentic and not just an idea. And then experiment with daring to receive what we don't want. And then to let whatever happens happen in the spaciousness of our breath and our body and our practice and the spaciousness of the Absolute. Just see what happens. It's an experiment. It's the central practice of relative bodhicitta, but it's not something that we can just do by reading about it or even hearing about it. It requires practice. It requires the very practice that we're all engaged in right now, in this moment. And I'd like to end just by reading a few words from Koan Yamada. So this other text that we read this morning, Compassion Unbound. Just as sunshine breaks through clouds, the compassionate light of our essential nature shines through the cracks in our delusion. Compassion unbound naturally flows out beyond duality. It is absolute and universal love. It's the compassion of the one body. As we gradually clarify the heart's eye, the eye that sees the absolute, we more and more clearly experience this unbound compassion. We come to love everything with immeasurable depth, and we know that all things completely love us. This naturally opens a life of infinite gratitude and peace. So don't believe what he's saying, but taste this for yourself. And that bell ringing will bring us to the end of our talk. So please make yourselves comfortable. Alan will, once his foot comes back from being asleep, answer that door. And you know that this talk is being recorded, so anything that you want not recorded, please just tell us to stop. Take your time, Alan. And let's go around and say our names. I'm Melissa.
I'm Camden.
Jenny.
Ray.
Craig.
Susan.
Paul. Harold.
Fabian.
Debbie.
David.
So, you know what to do, questions, observations, whatever's coming up for you. Yes?
Thank you for that. I've been struggling now for some weeks. I was reading that book about Zen difficult times, and two of the essays recommended some kind of practice like this to deal with difficult times. May I be at peace, may I be happy, mm-hmm. and so forth. And I hadn't thought about that for a while, and it seemed contradictory to the non-dualistic practice. And, mm-hmm. you know, without any instruction, I did for a while recite to myself a Jack Cornfield piece where I wished myself to be filled with loving kindness and peaceful and ease, and then out into the universe until I reached certain politicians. But I stopped because it seemed like I was saying, you know, may I be at peace? Well, I wasn't always at peace. My loved ones be well. They weren't always well. And so it was setting up for me an expectation that things would be other than they are. So I stopped, and your talk makes me think it's just too early in my practice to do that kind of thing. that I'm not grounded enough. Because it invited an expectation that things would be other than they are.
Right, right.
But it did invoke compassion.
Of course. Well, and it's very powerful to use that kind of language. But you're right, it's limited. And when I was a mindfulness teacher, that was part of our curriculum. We had to teach loving-kindness practices, just very much like what you're saying. And I really struggled with it. And then I found a way in that was more like this, that wasn't dualistic anymore, and changed the languaging around that, changed the way we talked about it. So instead of, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, it's actually in the original teachings from the Pali language, it doesn't say that. It says, may I be present in my fear, right? Because that was the original teaching of the Buddha. His monks were scared, and he wanted to reassure them. So may I be in my fear. And so we've been saying, may I be free in the midst of my fear, like which combines the relative and the absolute. And you'd think people wouldn't understand it. And boy, they get it right away. Oh, this is possible. May I be awake in my fear. And then instead of being happy, may I be awake in my mental disturbances. May I be awake in my physical pain. That's the third one. And then may I care for myself with ease, because you have to bring yourself into the picture there. Very similar teachings to Tonglen, but from the older tradition, right? And so in Zen, we hate techniques, right? And all the, and Norm Fisher says that too. But there's a way to use these traditional techniques, which are dualistic, and find a way into them through the non-dual. And it feels important to do that. Otherwise, I think we're betraying our understanding, and it's like putting icing on a cake instead of mixing the batter up, making sure all the ingredients are in it.
And I think the we can get lost in the absolute in Zen, and I know you're not talking about this. Well, it's everything is fine, so I don't have to, do anything. So I think there also is the when we can do something, we do it. And sometimes just there is something we can do for something. Send a card, send flowers. I really hope you have a speedy recovery. And that we can genuinely and should genuinely wish for that. And I think these practices are quite tricky in that way, and that this desire that, of course, we would not want our loved ones or other people to suffer. Like, of course we feel that way, and that can lead us to you should stop suffering because it makes me uncomfortable when you suffer. Please stop crying because I'm a little bit uncomfortable now. And so in some ways this Tonglen, I think one of the most powerful things we can do for someone who is suffering is to be with them without trying to change it. Right? That is... And then we're tapping into... And what Melissa said, this ultimate bodhicitta, this compassion unbound, from the Zen perspective, we say we don't have to cultivate compassion, because compassion is the nature of everything. And if we stop trying to fix things or run away, then we can begin to touch this compassion beyond like and don't like. So that there is compassion. It's not that there isn't compassion, but our little wanting to make it better sometimes is actually the opposite of compassion. We are not willing to suffer with. So this Tonglen practice, part of it is consciously turning toward the pain and difficulty and just being with it, and trusting that then we're not the one who does or has to do the transformation. You cannot transform anything. But when we let things be, we can see, oh, everything is already transforming. and we can participate with the universe, with this bodhicitta. Not be, well, I will be the great bodhicitta guy. You know, that's my job. I'm going to just compassion the heck out of everybody. But trusting that there is this ground of compassion that includes terror and tears and great pain, all of it included. So, thanks.
I like the ship of compassion because it speaks so nicely of the relative and the absolute and doesn't come strong on one side or the other. It just leaves you there. The other compassion unbound, you know, talks nicely about it initially, and then at the end says you will be filled with gratefulness and, you know, peace. And it's like, wait a minute.
Right.
You know, that's sort of saying that there's a separate self that will be experiencing those things. And I kind of like, and peace and gratefulness will arise.
Yeah.
And because can't own any of it. So that the welcoming of whatever arises. And that arises for me, it's like, okay, that's a gift of, you know, of doing the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And not owning any of it. And so it's for me, and what you've talked about, David, nicely, it's like stuff arises and not owning it, mm-hmm. not owning any of it, or whatever shows up, thoughts, sensations, whatever, to be met, you know, and received. You know, for me, this is the practice. But it's so easy to want to own it, keep talking about it, and not owning any of it.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because in my mind, as I was finishing up reading it, I was about to say, and don't believe a word of this. And the doorbell rang over it, over the last few words, and I just got so startled. I forgot that I was going to say that. I thought, well, I might as well just end and start talking. But this is a really important point, that if we buy into any of this, even the stuff I said about absolute bodhicitta, it's a mistake. It has to be tasted. You can't, a cook who doesn't know what their food tastes like is not a good cook, right? You have to be able to know what this is for yourself, and only then can you share it with other people. So I get the feeling that Koan Yamada knew what he was talking about, but he makes it so rigid in a way, right? Yeah. You will feel this. And who knows, this is a translation from Japanese, so we don't really know what he actually said. It might have been gentler. But I really think that's such an important warning. Thank you for mentioning it, giving me the opportunity to affirm it. Because, what? We don't want to do that.
Well, and this other aspect of the Tonglen, and you talked about it being a dualistic practice, so it's breathing in the negative or the dark and starting with these qualities. And as I understand it, it is actually intentionally breathing out light and coolness and giving away whatever we think we have. So this giving it away feels like part of that. We're not having to generate light in this, but we breathe out light and love and all of that. So it is a technique. It is dualistic. As if there were dark and light, and there is dark and light, but breathing that in, not having to transform anything, I so appreciate that clarity, but then some intention to give away whatever understanding, whatever love, whatever peace we have, we give it away.
Well, and that's the essential point, I think. We tend not to want to take on negative. And when positive arises, we kind of want to keep it for ourselves. So this is the opposite of what human beings normally do. We take in what's painful. And when the generation of the lightness arises, we just go, there you go, out into the world. Yeah, so you can feel how tricky and edgy it is. It's almost impossible to talk about it. because it goes right into I'm doing something to make things better. And yeah, oof, it's really hard. Really hard to talk about.
I just want to appreciate the some of the images that you're using, because it's possible, and I have to confess that, you know, I read the book Start Where You Are by Ramachandran a long time ago, and some things I got, but some things I missed. In fact, I didn't even remember the whole context of the Lojong teachings.
Yeah.
You know, but I remember it being mostly about Tonglen, because she really emphasizes that. And it's possible to really make it mechanical, and kind of like you're this filtration system, and you're sucking in this muddy water, and then you're expelling this, you know, pure water. Not the mud's all building up. And so I really found that helpful, the metaphor about adding salt to the ocean, that, you know, that and combining it with that a bigger container teaching. That's just so helpful, so that we're not stuck with this idea that, you know, a lot of us grew up in a Christian culture, taking on the sins of the world, you know, making yourself the sacrificial lamb. I think it's easy for some of us who grew up in a Christian church, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's easy for some of us, you know, to go that way and make this a kind of martyrdom practice. And then, you know, that not, as David just emphasized from your talk, not having to transform anything. You know, we're not working magic. And then just breathing out whatever we're breathing out. Not some clarified, purified thing that we've created for the universe.
That's the essential point. We didn't do it.
Right.
But there's a trust that it does happen. And we don't keep it. That's where our active technique mind gets to get used. We're consciously bringing in and consciously giving away. Sending and receiving is what it's called.
Right. And Trungpa actually is quite wonderful in his description. He says, don't make a big deal out of it. Mm-hmm. Anything in this direction is fine. Breathe in bad, breathe out good. You know, so I guess, like all things, we can get in endless debates about what shikantaza is. Is it and parse all this stuff, when actually it's kind of a jumping in place. And you know, so here's some ideas. As Melissa said, see what happens when you do it.
And I think that simplistic view can be misused. Mm-hmm. And I've heard it misused many times.
Sure.
And read about it being misused. You know, when people sometimes come to the temple and say, I'm doing Tonglen practice. Say, well, what is that for you? And it's this simple version, but it does a disservice to what is possible, I think, in Tonglen practice. Yeah, thank you. Oh, Tom, did you have your hand up?
No, I'm in my regular confusion.
Well, breathe that in.
Nothing's for me.
So breathe it in. See what happens.
I like to be able to budget my time with practice, and like, you know, 25 minutes, like, what is my practice going to be, you know, while I'm on the cushion for that day? Or, you know, how do you build practices like this into your schedule or like your life? You know, because whenever I sit, I'm tempted, you know, to sit zazen, you know, and to focus on my breath and have that be my practice. But then these like additives.
That's a good word.
Our teaching and our way is that everything is right here. That all of these practices, all of these angles actually arise in our zazen. Hakuin says, devotion, repentance, training, the many paramitas all have their source in zazen. So the Zen way that we still actually recommend, is that if you sit with your breath, if you encounter the moment, all of these things arise. For the first 15 years of my practice, I was told not to read very much and not to study. And then after that, I went and started reading the sutras and these other things, and I'd go, oh yeah, I know. Because naturally, the heart opens up, and naturally we do this. So I would recommend giving yourself to the vast Dharmakaya, the vast whatever arises in the moment, really trusting that whatever you need to work on, whatever state you need to be in, you will, and that these teachings are not outside of you. And it's such a good question, because as we, the reason we don't talk about teachings is exactly that, because people, well, I got my formula, I do 10% ethanol and 25% this, and then I put a little detergent in, and then my race car goes. So they're actually, the formula is breathe in, breathe out. And I think this is our, the wonderful thing. Zen maybe is for those of us that, I don't know, either want the whole thing. There's a kind of wild faith in it. So I would say we teach these, and sometimes they'll come up. You'll notice, rest in the openness of mind. Comes up just for me as phrases throughout the sutra book come up, right? You're sitting and suddenly, for some reason, you know, something, you know, somebody said comes up, and we trust that. And so our practice is always shifting. But I would encourage you not to make plans and not to budget.
Okay. Well, and just to add on to that, because I was having the same thought, Zazen is not just what we do on the cushion. It permeates all 24 hours of the day, 7 days a week. It is a life of Zen. So it's the formal practice, you know, and Alan talked the other day about post-meditation, which is not a word we use in Zen, because there is no post-meditation. There's just Zazen all the time. Even though the Za means sitting in Japanese. There's walking zazen, we call it kinhin, and there's eating zazen, we call it orioki, and there's, you know, being with your friends and having beer zazen. And, it's real life. Yeah. So it's very important to, it goes back to the ship of compassion again, you know, the night rain permeates, the cliffs are filled with dew. It starts to leak off the cushion, and we begin to notice that it arises all the time. So just to be careful about that. And then the other thing is too, all these techniques, I mean, if you look at Buddhist practice, the Theravada, all the Tibetan practices, even in Zen, you know, people will come in and say, I'm sort of bored with breath. Could I do a koan? You know, cause we don't like to just sit with things as they are. And one of the ways we might fiddle around with practice is in Dzogchen. That's why one of the unique things about Zen is this regular face-to-face meeting where you can come in and say, I want to do something different. It's just not working for me. Can you hear the relative in that statement? You know, I don't know. I can't. Or people who've been working with koans, it's not working for me. It doesn't matter. Whenever you feel that in yourself, like, whoa, this isn't working for me. What does that mean? What does not working mean? It implies we have an idea of what things should be. So it's really important that the teacher and student don't get caught in that together, because, man, I got a big bag of techniques I could hand out to you. And I have to be very careful to not do that, because the desire for entertainment is so strong in human beings.
Right.
That's why breath practice is the beginning practice and the middle practice and the end practice. It's so important. And every once in a while, some things that, you know, a little variety almost makes us see the importance of that steady zazen that permeates everything. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't switch around, but watch the reason why we want to switch around. It's often because we want some result. And just to be careful, it's not a bad thing. It's very human. This is such a mysterious practice. This is not, you can't, you know, all these koans are, what is Zen? Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? You know, what is the meaning of reality? And people say things like, moo, you know, to answer those questions, and, you know, and shit stick, and I'm tired, I can't answer you today. They're all answers. Mm. Yeah, because what is it? What is it? And that's why one of the main Korean practices is just to say, what is it? What is it? But again, that's a layering on of another thing, right? So you can see it's impossible. And that's what we emphasize, sitting still and upright in the middle of everything. That's awesome. Thank you.
And just to say, too, that sometimes these techniques or phrases can be really helpful when we get really stuck. You know, remembering, you know, thinking of resting in the, you know, the openness of mind. Oh, maybe I can just rest here. Little things, anyway.
Yeah, so not right or wrong.
Right, yeah.
And be careful about motivation. You know, if it's to distract us from the thing that's right here. But if it's to nourish the thing that's right here, that's it. And that's why working it out. You know, so I've worked with students who come in and say, well, my practice this week is this. Because I read about it in a book or a magazine article. And I say, oh, okay. I don't say don't do it. But, you know, you can almost feel the searching. Our practice is, right? Yeah. And. Dot, dot, dot. Great to have this other stuff, as David's saying. So many people end there today, so just coming back into our sitting posture.